Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. As Americans keep a wary eye on the American economy, tariffs, the prospect and implications of full employment, worries about a potential recession, most of us remain focused on our personal budgets and our personal relationship with money, and that is where Rick Kaler comes in. He is founder and president of the Kaler Financial Group and the author of several books on financial therapy. He is a frequent guest on In the Moment, but we've never met in person. So we're broadcasting live this week from SDPB's Rapid City studio, and we're here in the South Dakota Community Foundation gallery with a live audience here. So folks, thanks for stopping by. And Rick Kaler, thanks for being here in the studio with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And it's really great to finally meet you in person after talking to you for several hours.
You're right. And we were just saying, why isn't there a financial therapist on every corner? Because so many people have questions and thoughts about money and challenges with money, celebrations with money. Why is this a field that's just sort of taking off now?
Yeah, it really, the financialtherapyassociation.org just was started in 2010. And it's pretty embryonic as a profession. And when I talk with people about what we do, and I explain financial therapy pretty shortly, in that 90% of all of our financial decisions are made emotionally. Yeah. And yet the therapists, the mental health profession, really is somewhat resistant around money. And your numbers folks, your financial advisors, financial planners, aren't taught anything around behavioral change. And so you have this huge gap of in the middle where we all live, and nobody's bringing those two components together. So it is interesting that it's taken quite a while for this to surface, and even now there's no degree in financial therapy. I think someday there will be. And finding one is really difficult. I teach a class at Golden Gate University, virtually, obviously, and I give them an assignment to go interview financial therapists. And one said, in the entire state of California, there's only five.
Wow. And you're really one of the pioneers of this field through the work that you're doing, you know, with individuals and the books that you've published. You're kind of leading this right now, which is it's exciting to watch, especially as a South Dakotan, realizing that so much of this thinking is coming from South Dakota. Is it exciting to be part of? Because you have to know, that 50 years from now, this is going to be on everybody's, sort of talking point about money.
Yeah, I can go off now on my proud of South Dakota rampage. But when I travel around the country, people say, wow, this is really cutting edge stuff. Where do you live? New York, California? I said, no, Rapid City, South Dakota. That really short circuits their thinking. Yeah. So it's really cool that this has originated not solely, but certainly we've been a real force behind the movement.
Why here? Why do you live here? Why do you love living here?
I'm asked that quite a bit. I had a occupational therapist ask me that once after extensive testing. Why do you live in Rapid City? You should live in London or New York. I say, well, is it okay that's where I vacation? but I live here because I've always lived here.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful place to come back home to. I love traveling. I love different cultures. But it's hard to beat Rapid City.
This is home. All right, so you can find a lot of our conversations on the website. You could really get quite an education at listen.sdpb.org and then put Rick Kaler's name in the search engine. Let's catch people up to one of the topics we were talking about last time before we move forward, and we were dealing with money disorders, and today we're going to move into problematic money behavior. Help me figure out the
difference. It's a test question for my class.
All right.
money disorders that we talked about last time are workaholism, compulsive buying, gambling, hoarding, and financial dependence. All of these can be found in something called the DSM-5. The DSM-5 is somewhat of the diagnostic Bible of the mental health profession. Right. So in some form or fashion, you can tie those disorders back to, if I'd call it certified mental health issues. And I think last time we even talked about there's a big chasm within the mental health profession around diagnosis. There's some that feels that objectifies a person, sure, and that they'd rather treat the person rather than the diagnosis. But nevertheless, there's some recognition of financial problems in psychology, which is kind of a big deal. Because we were involved, I think, back in 2008 or 9 in the first clinical study of problematic money disorders. Up until that time, the mental health profession had no studies around are money issues even issues? And we were able to demonstrate scientifically that people can make progress with these disorders. So then the problematic money behaviors are something that you wouldn't find in that particular book. All right. And I think probably more of us can relate to the problematic money behaviors because they're pretty common.
All right, let's get started with what some of those problematic money behaviors are. We begin with denial, which we already know I have.
Well,
it's hard, and it sometimes just even opening the checkbook stresses me out. But now I recognize that it is that denial and that I just need to take the next step.
We have a lot of company. 36%, a survey showed 36% of all Americans are in or practice financial denial.
Yeah. This is, for an example, this is what it can look like as I have diagnosed myself now. Sometimes I look in my checking account and there'll be a whole lot of money in there. And I'm like, I know I shouldn't have that much. I have forgotten to pay my bills. And so then I'll go in and I'm like, okay, now you have to get to it. And so sometimes it shows up and what's happening to where I didn't even think about, you know, I didn't want to look. I had the money to pay the bill. It wasn't a hardship. Just transfer it, write the check.
Yeah.
Maybe I should automate it.
That could be one.
Or would that be feeding into my denial?
Not necessarily, because you're actually addressing it. You're doing something to address the denial.
Yeah.
So it takes awareness, concentration, and focus on the issue to set up automated bill paying.
Okay.
So, you know, that's actually a way of coming out of financial denial. Financial denial is, someday I'll do that, and then I never get to someday.
Right. And it's bigger than just forgetting to pay your electric bill. Expand on what financial denial really looks like in people's lives.
Yeah, it's avoidance. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to spend any energy on it. I want to completely resist anything having to do with money. Mm-hmm. And that's a big warning sign. I mean, it's a big warning sign with anything. When we absolutely don't want to do that, it begs the question, well, tell me more. Why? Why the resistance? Why, what's going on? And I think in a lot of cases, there is some type of discomfort, emotional discomfort, pain of some type. It certainly doesn't make a person feel good,
right,
to focus on that. And so the questions become, well, what are the stories that you're telling yourself? What's the narrative that's playing in your head around, I don't want to look at my checkbook, or I don't want to do this. I have gone through my phases of financial denial, which is a little bit unusual for someone in the financial profession. Mm-hmm. You tend to not see financial denial as much.
Yeah.
But for me, it was started back when the B-52s left Rapid City, and the B-1s were coming in, but they missed it by about 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. So we had huge vacancy rate in Rapid, about 25% at the time. And I remember at that time I owned a few houses, and I was trying to build some wealth. And if all of my rentals were full, I still wrote a check for $1,500 a month. Mm. And that was a lot of money to me. So I learned, wow, this is painful. I just won't look at my checking account. I just won't look at my statements. Why? Because I got paralyzed in fear. It was paralyzing. And I'm like, you know, I don't think this is good. I need to pretend this isn't happening so I can continue to function. So that's how my brain made sense of that. The crazy thing was, maybe 10, 15, 20 years later, I still wasn't looking. Hmm. And one day I looked. I mean, I got all of my courage up, and I looked at my financial statements, and I was in shock. It was kind of like you seeing more money in the checkbook than ought to be. And I'm like, well, wait, what is going on? There's money here.
Yeah.
And so that's how the denial, that's how I coped. Right. And today, I would have said, well, I really need to look at that fear and embrace that fear and really face into to what's going on and look behind what's freezing me up. But it went on. It became a behavior that went way past the point of it being useful to me.
See, and here's the power of Rick Kaler as I see it. As you were talking about that, I was like, oh, I remember that year that I had a hard time paying that electric bill. I remember it. It comes from an experience that I had, even though now that's not my situation. I'm remembering how painful it was to open it and to not have the money and to try to figure out where was that going to come from and what the heck was going to happen to us if we didn't figure this out. So if you have sort of a traumatic experience, we've talked about that, those traumatic experiences in your past, they can linger.
Well, you bring up a really good point. And that's, it's like a form of PTSD. Mm-hmm. Is I remember those times when I opened the checking account and how am I going to pay the bills and all of the difficult emotions that go with that. And so 5 or 10 years later, when a person doesn't have the same circumstances or things have gotten better, they haven't necessarily gotten better in the limbic system.
Right.
It's still remembering that pain. It's like, oh, I don't want to open this up. And because it's painful every time I do. Mm. And that's a really good point. What could be going on for a lot of folks is I never really finished that business. I never really worked through the pain. I never embraced it. I never acknowledged that pain. And so it just sits there, dogging us for years. And we wonder, why do I have this reaction?
Yeah. Sometimes just talking about it unpacks that a little bit. Should we move on to underspending and overspending as problematic behaviors? It seems like those are, or should we talk maybe about how do you know that you're sort of in denial? Do you want to deal with what do you ask yourself to find out if this is something you need to think of?
Yeah, you can, there's three questions that you can ask yourself. I think they're all pretty obvious. You know, first, do you avoid thinking about money?
Right.
Do you try to forget about your financial situation? Or do you avoid opening up bills or looking at your financial situation?
Right.
Obviously, all indicators of being in financial denial.
People of all wealth, you know, people with very little to live on and people with great wealth have this problem. There's no necessarily litmus test for on an income base.
Absolutely, and I'm so glad you brought that up, that this, while this probably affects lower earners, a little more than upper. It is not. You can't be that general about it. You can literally have millions of dollars and be in financial denial. I've worked with people making $5 million a year that had negative net worth and refused to look at their financial situation.
Let's talk about underspending.
Oh, yes.
Is this the same thing as being cheap? Thrifty? Or my neighbor would say, I think I can say this, my neighbor says I'm Dutch. That's how he explains. Is I'm just Dutch.
One of my associates says, Rick, it's not cheap. It's inexpensive.
All right, underspending. What does underspending look like?
Underspending, the first time I ever looked at this, I was kind of like, get a grip. Because we talked about money scripts right. In a previous segment, and my main money scripts fall in the category of money vigilant. And so to me, underspending is a badge of honor, right? And so how could there be anything wrong with underspending? And yet, this is classic Ebenezer Scrooge, who had a lot of money but ate very poorly. It's kind of interesting because frugality is the number one predictor of the ability to accumulate wealth, more than what your income is, what you invest in, what your career is, all of those other things. There's not as much commonality as frugality, which kind of makes a little bit sense. Yeah. We've got to be able to live on less than what comes in. So with underspending, especially with somebody frugal, it's like you don't turn that off, especially when you retire. And at some point in time, the underspending, there's a balance. It is not living on everything you make underspending, not necessarily. It could be a really great balance. But the underspending we're talking about isn't necessarily being frugal. It's being frugal to the point of harming yourself. And I'm thinking of a client that I had for many, many, many years. They had an income of $36,000 to $40,000 a year. They could afford to easily spend $120,000. And when they'd come in, I'd work with them and talk to them about, you know, what would you like to do? Would you like to take a trip around the world? And I remember he'd turn to her and say, honey, would you like to take a trip around the world? She'd say, I don't know. I'm really happy as it is. And yet, when I went out to their home, they had exposed wires. They had holes in decks. They had steps that were unsafe. They had handrails that were falling off. They were starting to get in that period of time where maybe they shouldn't be driving. And they had a very old car that didn't have the most recent safety features. So this is classic underspending, where we're underspending to the point that our money isn't supporting us.
Mm. What are the questions that you should be asking yourself to determine whether or not underspending is problematic for you?
One question is, do you avoid spending money on yourself or other people? Do you have a significant amount of money saved, but you just refuse to spend it because of the fear? Do you routinely do without things that would make your life more comfortable, even if you can afford them? Mm-hmm. Again, our money is to support us. Do you routinely avoid participating in activities you would enjoy or could afford because you don't want to spend money? And there we're face to face with money scripts, aren't we? Do you feel ashamed or guilty about having money? That's a big one. Does it seem as if you never quite have enough to feel secure? Mm-hmm. And finally, do you deny yourself basic dental, visual, hearing, other routine medical care?
your heart kind of gets in when you start realizing people living with some of those, you know, really what's going on inside. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back with more of this conversation with financial therapist Rick Kaler. You're on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're broadcasting live this week from SDPB Studios in Rapid City. And sitting next to me at the table, Rick Kaler, financial therapist. There's many books that Rick has written. You can find them online. Two of my favorite are Wired for Wealth and The Financial Wisdom of Ebenezer Scrooge, which is when I find out I was kind of a Bob Cratchit sort of person. And I was like, but isn't he the noble one? And then I was reading the book, and I was like, yes, but Bob has some issues that have played out in my life as well. So
that's another test question in my course.
I'm going to nail this test by the time we're done with these. So we're talking today about problematic money behaviors, and we've gone over financial denial and underspending. Let's talk about overspending.
Overspending.
It sounds way more fun.
And it can be a lot more fun. This is pretty much an epidemic in the United States. 70% of people have reported some type of stress around too much debt.
70%?
70%. And that makes some sense when I think of other studies that show 70% of Americans live month to month, hand to mouth. There's some statistics being circulated that 70-75% of Americans would need to borrow or in some way sell something to come up with $1,000. So it's pretty much an epidemic when you think of how short money is. I mean, think of the government shutdown that happened last year sometime. And in missing one check, I forget what the numbers were, but it was staggering how many people had to go borrow money to get them through the month. So overspending is a big deal, and it comes from a number of money scripts, especially that I deserve this, I work hard. There can be all sorts of narratives and all sorts of stories we tell ourselves about why we need to spend. What makes the most sense to me is, because we're emotional creatures, because our emotional brain makes 90% of our financial decisions, it would make sense that when I'm faced with a financial decision, whichever one kind of lights me up emotionally, that's probably what I'm going to lean toward. Mm-hmm. So when I think of spending on something or spending on a cup of coffee or a book or something that I love versus, you know, I could send that money off to this black hole called an IRA. Which one really calls to me? And so often our brains are wired for that immediate gratification. And it doesn't mean something is wrong with you, because that is how the brain is wired. For people who can send it to the IRA, they have reframed that to where sending it to the IRA is the bigger emotional charge. And that's the abnormal brain.
And that can be done?
Oh, absolutely.
You can reframe something so that it's actually more pleasurable to not buy the book.
Yeah.
Because you have another goal. How do you do that?
Well, for example, somebody that will send it off to the IRA, they're going to look at that cup of coffee or that book, and maybe we should be talking about something bigger like a vacation in the Bahamas. Mm-hmm. And they're going to probably engage the cerebral cortex, which is hard. It takes work. Thinking is work. That's why we make so many decisions, you know, in the moment in our limbic system. And looking at that, what this person would tell themselves is, you know, I could take that vacation. That would really be nice. That'd be cool. But I've done some math, and I'm a little short on my retirement fund. And if I sent that to retirement, and I have enough money saved at retirement, instead of spending a week there, I probably could afford to spend a month at some point in time in my life. That would be a positive reframe, that, yeah, I could spend a week, but if I did this, I might even be able to live there. Mm-hmm. There's a negative reframe, and that is, if I spend money on this Bahama vacation, I'm probably going to end up being a bag lady, which is a negative, but it nevertheless it's emotional charge. And sure. if that fear is greater than spending the money and that I'm going to save it, then a person will save it.
Yeah. So my daughter filed her first taxes maybe a year ago, I can't remember now, and she got $1 back, and she put it, you know, to for the future or whatever. It's a dollar, you know, and I was just kind of watching her figure this out, and she said, future Jane will really thank me. And she kind of laughed, and I thought, I did not teach her that.
Wow.
But she was already, so her brain is clearly wired to think about the future in a way that I have to maybe work a little harder at. So how much of that thinking about the future, thinking I won't be eating cat food when I'm 70 because I, you know, made the responsible decision when I was 30, how much of future thinking and planning is really part of rewiring some of those behaviors?
Yeah, I think it's probably pretty crucial. Yeah. To look at the future. When we look at Ebenezer Scrooge, part of his transformation was he first looked into his past to find out where the unfinished business was, and then that helped him to be able to see stuff in the present he was never able to see. It freed up all of that space that he was carrying on past issues. And then he was able to look at the future and see that clearly. And so what you just have explained with your daughter, I mean, wow, as a parent, that is pretty cool, because I don't know for a buck that I would have rolled that forward. But, I mean, that is an amazing awareness, because if you'll do that with a dollar, you're going to do it with 100, with 1,000, with 10,000.
Right.
And that's really where it begins, isn't it, with the little things.
Yay.
Yeah.
All right, what are
yeah.
the questions we need to ask about overspending? How do you know when it's a problem and it's actually doing some damage in your life, and when it's just sort of the harmless kind of thing that all of us do on a, you know, on a weekend when there's a great bookstore in downtown Rapid City and I fully intend to buy a book there?
Yeah.
So how do you know when it's a big deal and when is it just, that's spending money?
Well, I'm going to use a bad word now. Do you have trouble sticking to a budget?
Budget.
Oh, yeah, budget. And we've talked about the fact that very successful people that can live on less than what they make, they have a budget, but it's very rarely a written out detailed budget. They take care of everything that's important first: taxes, maybe charitable giving, funding their retirement plans, funding their emergency plans. They have a list of this comes off the top, whatever's left, that's what I'll spend. Mm-hmm. That's still a budget. Do you avoid even making a budget because you know it will show that you're spending more than your income? Now we've brought in a little financial denial with
right.
this too. Do you purchase things with money that you don't have? And if you think about it, every time we use a credit card, we are taking out a loan for whatever we're buying. Mm. So if we asked ourselves, would I spend $3,000 at a store on a bunch of, would I go to a bank, sit down and ask for a loan on $3,000 worth of clothes or whatever it might be that I can't afford? Well, when we think of it that way, no, probably I wouldn't. But that's what we're doing when we use the credit card. Do you carry a balance on your credit card from month to month? I love credit cards. I love getting the travel points. But it's really important to pay them off every month because the interest is unbelievable. I don't even know how they figure it. I missed a payment once. And all these charges appeared on my bill, and I tried to go through and tie out how are they figuring this? And I couldn't figure it out. Yeah. It was expensive. I can let you know that. Are you too broke at the end of the month to save for retirement? And that's pretty ubiquitous. Do you frequently lose sleep or fight with your spouse about your spending or your debt?
Those are pretty insightful questions.
Yeah, they can be questions that are really difficult. And even another one is, do you hide the amount of your debt or your spending from your spouse?
We've talked about that
financial infidelity.
Yeah. All right.
And I think 43% of people are guilty of that.
We will take another break. We'll come back with more with Rick Kaler. You're on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're talking this hour with financial therapist Rick Kaler. He's president and founder of the Kaler Financial Group right here in Rapid City and is one of the leading voices on financial therapy, really a pioneer in the field. We're talking today about problematic money behaviors, and as we are apt to do, we're not going to make it through the whole list today, so we're going to have Rick on in the future as we go through these, because this next one, I just don't want to tick off, you know, here's one, here's the next, because I have questions.
Yes, good questions.
And this is financial enabling.
And this is a big one. Yeah, it is a big one. I probably see this more in my practice than any other problematic behavior. It would make sense that I don't see overspending a lot because my clientele, when I say my clientele, as a financial planner, my clientele typically has been able to save money. As a financial therapist, overspending, of course, would be very common. But common to both is financial enabling. And this takes a lot of forms with the parents. I mean, I can think of a client we recently had that was spending to the point of hurting her retirement. Mm. And we ran the numbers and said, if you continue at this, you are going to run out of money. Now that's pretty sobering.
Right.
And how difficult it was for her to start ramping down the support. And usually there is a lot of guilt that is associated with financial enabling. It's somewhat common that there's guilt around a parent's behaviors when the child was young or when they were raising them, where there's remorse and regret. And so this is a way to attempt to make those wrongs right. That's a very, very popular one. We've got to look at anytime we're giving money, is this helpful giving or is it hurtful giving? And that can be a real tough thing to do. And you can see how these problematic behaviors play into one another, because it could be just as easy to go into denial.
Right. And so many, when you talk about parents with children, adult children perhaps, you must hear, if I don't do this, they'll be on the street. If I don't do this, they'll have to drop out of college. Or, you know, whatever the scenario is that's sort of driving the poor decision, there's the sense that if I don't make this sacrifice of my own financial future, I am specifically causing this bad thing to happen, you know, to my kids who, I don't want to see suffer, or to a friend, or to, you know, a spouse or whomever. For someone else. Do you see that?
Absolutely. I mean, that's front and center of a lot of the stories that are going on, is if I don't do this, nobody else will, and the child is going to, as you said, end up on the street or not get through college or et cetera, et cetera. And that's where we need to really start asking ourselves the hard questions. And that's where it can be really helpful to have somebody else asking questions that we won't ask of ourselves. Like, well, tell me more about what's so bad about dropping out of college. Are there any folks that you know that didn't complete college that were successful, or where dropping out of college was actually a plus? Because we make up a story, and it can be a money script that, well, to be successful, you've got to graduate from college.
And a specific college, maybe.
And yeah. Absolutely.
You have to graduate from that college, yeah.
Totally. Mm-hmm. And we could spend another hour on that question about college shopping and the cost of that. So there's so many assumptions that we make that are just, we don't even know we're making an assumption.
Right.
That's just the way life is. And there is a huge amount of guilt around college and parents feeling and having the money script that a good, loving parent is going to pay the way for their kids to go to college, or pay some of the way, to the to their own hurt, to their own retirement
plan. That's key.
Plan.
Yeah, there's nothing inherently wrong with paying for, we need to be clear.
Yeah, yeah,
paying
absolutely.
For your kids' college is not necessarily a bad thing.
No.
If it is devastating your own finances, you have to be real about the damage
exactly.
that it could be doing.
And this gets to looking into the future that we talked about a little bit ago, is if we look at the stats on parents who haven't planned for their own retirement, a child is going to spend a lot more money supporting their parents in retirement when they haven't provided for themselves than they would paying for their own college education.
Right.
It's staggering. I mean, many times more. So the loving thing could be to allow the child to pay for their college education. Well, then they can't go to Yale. Well, Yale will cost you $250,000, and the average starting salary out of Yale is $55,000. South Dakota School of Mines will cost you about $75,000, and the starting salary out of school is $67,000 or $70,000.
Right. And this brings up this big, because I happen to know, since my daughter just has done the whole college application thing, that Yale, for example, is a need-based school. So if you have a smaller income, it's not going to cost you that much. So Yale might be a really good college to apply for. But my point of this is, this whole notion of college having shifted, and my question for you is, you know, things have changed. You know, when I went to college, it's a totally different conversation than when my daughter is going to college. And sometimes people get caught up in that too, where they think the college should look like this, when really it doesn't look like that anymore. It looks like something entirely different. We also have to figure that out as well.
Exactly. I think the way I've made sense of it is education is important. And education comes through a lot of different venues than just college. And so we're back to the question in enabling, is this helping my child and not hurting me? Mm-hmm. And enabling, it's usually this is hurting my child and it's also hurting me. It's kind of like a lose-lose.
And people think that comes from love. Does it come from love? And is it, where does it come from?
Oh, that's a great question. oftentimes it is not coming from love, and that's really hard to hear. Mm. It is coming from the avoidance of fear. It's actually oftentimes much more selfish than it is
control.
Love.
There's a control factor,
it's control. It can be manipulation. It can be really all about absolving my guilt.
Yeah.
Not necessarily helping the child. Because, again, when we look at the stats, it's going to be a loving thing in some cases to allow the child to figure it out on their own, pay for their college, get some debt, maybe go to a college that's cheaper, and me take care of my retirement. But I can spin it that, well, I'm just a loving parent, and this is just the right thing to do to sacrifice myself.
And we're using the example of college, which for some people is irrelevant or a luxury. It could be food. It could be I'm buying groceries for, you know, a sister or, you know, an ex-spouse. And if I don't, they'll go hungry. It could be a very fundamental, basic kind of financial enabling.
Yeah, and that could be, it could be a loving thing to do, and it also could be, I don't want to suffer the embarrassment of my child applying for food stamps. Even though the social net is there to take care of the child, that could be a driving issue. So it's, you know, one size doesn't fit all when it comes to this stuff.
Is this a particularly hard thing for people to unpack? It seems like this is really, overspending. You know, when we're talking about denial and we're like, oh, I have a bad experience and, you know, I need to go. That didn't seem particularly hard, unless your experience is really traumatic. But this one, to me, just seems like, whoa, looking at somebody and saying, you're enabling this person, that can cause a deep emotional reaction.
Well, this is why there aren't lines out of therapist doors. to look at yourself and your actions and to ask those questions and to wonder takes a person who is really intent on living life to the fullest. Mm-hmm. Because looking at this stuff is painful. That's why we don't look at it. That's why we don't want to ask ourselves a question. That's why we don't want to discover that this story I've made up about myself, that I'm this loving, wonderful parent who's writing checks for my child, isn't that wonderful, that I'm doing it from a completely manipulative, guilt-ridden, more selfish position.
What are some of the questions for financial enabling that you begin with?
Yeah, do you give money to others even though you can't afford it? Do you have trouble saying no to requests for money from your children, friends, or family members? That's a big one. Mm-hmm. And we could talk about in the future ways of setting up accounts that help you to say no. Do you sacrifice your own financial well-being for the sake of others? Classic codependency. Do you give or lend money without discussing and making clear arrangements for its repayments? That's another session on healthy giving or healthy loaning within families. Do you often feel resentment and anger after you've given money to others? So the payoff could be, I've just helped my son again and just have the anger, the being in a right. More of a victim role. Do you frequently feel taken advantage of or as if you're being regarded as the bank? And finally, do you ever lend money and either keep it secret or hide the exact nature of the interaction from your significant other? Again, financial infidelity.
Or maybe you're giving money to one child and not the others, but you're not telling that story to the others because you're afraid of the consequences of that. Ah, families.
setting up the estate battle.
Right. We will have more conversations in the future about more of these behaviors, but I want to leave people in our remaining 5 minutes or so, or even less, really, with some kind of optimistic and hopeful, you know, the important first step is, of course, to sort of come to an understanding, get past this unwillingness that we have sometimes to talk about money, to talk about money problems. We've sort of done that in this hour. And then what? So if you're listening and you said, that financial enabling, that is me. Okay, Rick Kaler, I've identified that this is a problem in my life. I can't just change it overnight. How do I begin?
Yeah, I suppose if a person hasn't turned off the radio by this time, they're still open. They're not in denial. The first thing is to cut yourself a little slack. A lot of us feel that we're terminally messed up and deficient because we have these disorders or these problematic behaviors. All of us have some degree of these. You know, I didn't go into every one of mine, but I find myself in these. So the first thing is to try and bring a little compassion to ourselves, which can be hard in itself, and to just the fact that you're aware of this gives you a chance to start asking some questions and maybe facing it. And you don't need to take it all at once. You don't need to make the change right tomorrow. It's more starting to work out a plan of how can I start changing incrementally? How can I start taking baby steps that are that I can accomplish? Something in the next 2 weeks, something in the next month, something after that. Because if a person says, okay, I am not going to be a financial enabler, I'm going to cut off my kids, that rarely works. Than anything else. Like, I'm going to stop hoarding. I'm going to cut up my credit cards. this doesn't work. All right. So it's coming up with a plan.
All right. So have some compassion. We all have gunk. It's okay to have gunk. A little gunk, a little money gunk.
That's
We've all got
good
it.
Technical term.
And if you didn't hear it in this hour, tune in next time when we cover the others that maybe apply to you. Have some compassion. Start talking about it. And tune in next time for Rick Kaler. Thank you so much for being here. It was so nice to meet you in person.
It was really
It's way more fun
here.
Than when the headphones, I have to say.
Yes,
it's,
absolutely.
Dynamic. So thanks so much. Thank you to our audience for being here and sharing this hour with us as well.